Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and kjzz.org with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today. We expect partly cloudy skies. There is a slight chance for some rain. And then for tonight, that chance becomes 30%. Look for lows to be in the mid-70s. For tomorrow, sunny, then with a slight chance for storms and a high of 95. Then we'll start the weekend off, sunny skies and a high of 95 on Saturday. It's currently partly cloudy and 90 at KJZZ. A nonprofit that has come under fire for hundreds of lawsuits against Valley businesses has now flooded the Attorney General's office with complaints. KJZZ's Will Stone reports advocates for individuals with disabilities, or AID, is already fighting the state in court.
The complaints are, in essence, a dare. AID's aggressive tactics of suing more than 1,700 businesses for violating the Americans with Disabilities Act recently led Attorney General Mark Brnovich to intervene in the cases, hoping to get them dismissed. Many of those sued end up paying thousands of dollars to go to court or to settle. Brnovich argues the group is abusing the judicial system for its own gain and should be coming to his office first, rather than immediately suing. This week, AID took him up on that request and delivered 20 boxes of ADA complaints to Brnovich's office. Attorney Jack Willinchek is representing AID.
And I'll guarantee you, those 9,000 cases are not going to get resolved in months, like the cases that AID has filed have, for the most part, been. AID has accomplished more in the space of months than the Attorney General's office has done in the space of 22, 26 years.
We're going to investigate every single one of these complaints.
That's Ryan Anderson with Brnovich's office.
What AID has accomplished is collecting likely over $1 million off of settlements from businesses over technical signage violations that did not bar anyone's access.
Anderson says they typically get 100 of these a year, so this amounts to about 90 years' worth of complaints. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Attorney General Mark Brnovich, along with the attorneys generals in Nevada, Texas, and Oklahoma, have filed suit to try and stop the transfer of the agency in charge of coordinating internet addresses and names. The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, is scheduled to be handed over to an international body on Saturday. And Attorney General Brnovich, what are your concerns with this arrangement?
We believe it is very important to make sure that all the consequences have been considered and thought through when it comes to turning over the keys to the internet. There's been no indication as to who or what or how that will happen, and we want some assurances that the internet will continue to run smoothly and freely, and devices will be able to communicate with each other, and that we want to make sure that there's predictability, certainty, and that protections are in place so that no one, including maybe foreign governments that don't share our concerns for the First Amendment, that's all protected.
What kinds of assurances would assure you about that?
Well, one of my great disappointments is that, frankly, this is an issue that Congress and the federal government should be addressing. As the state attorney general, what we're trying to do is slow down, or I'm trying to slow down the process. So what we want to see is some procedures in place to assure us that there's some sort of accountability issues that need to be resolved, that, you know, if this transition is unsuccessful, or if the system is mismanaged, I think the consequences for the global network would be severe.
In your mind, though, I mean, if the federal government has decided that it is no longer going to be in charge of this, are there things that this new coalition could do or say or have protections in place that would make you say, okay, like maybe this isn't going to be so bad?
I guess that's a possibility. And this is exactly what the problem is, though, is that we don't know what those oversights may or may not be. I'm not saying this necessarily would happen, but you could come up with hypotheticals where some government or even some private entity that has interest hostile to us or to our values ends up being in the catbird seat, and that could really undermine not only First Amendment protections, but, you know, we want to make sure that when Arizonans, for example, go to a .gov website, that they're going to a legitimate .gov website. So we want to make sure that we have that consistency, that certainty, that predictability. And, you know, I'm just concerned that, if history is any guide, very often when the United States, leaves its leadership role in these types of matters, matters, what ends up happening is a vacuum is created, and something ultimately is going to fill that vacuum.
That's Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, one of four attorneys general who filed suit to try and stop the planned transfer of the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN. To get a sense of what the agency itself thinks, we turn now to Chris Mondini. He's Vice President for Global Stakeholder Engagement at ICANN. And Chris, we just heard from Arizona's AG about his concern over another government taking control of the Internet and losing what it is now. Do you think that's a valid concern?
No, I think the concept of control and the Internet are really mutually exclusive. They don't work together. And even though it's understandable that people have concerns, it really shows a lack of awareness that the Internet is actually a network of independent networks. And they use some common technical aspects, such as an addressing system, to interconnect. And so ICANN is essentially the organization that updates and keeps the main address book that everyone needs to use to navigate the Internet. It's really nothing more than updating the addresses that we all use to connect our networks to each other.
Is there a sense, though, of sort of security knowing that the U.S. is sort of involved in this organization and can sort of serve as a backstop against, you know, something truly catastrophic happening?
Well, it's a very good question. At the early days of inception of ICANN, the then Clinton administration did set up this symbolic contract as a way to say to the world, look, we believe in a stakeholder-led, private sector-led coordination body for the address system. They always intended for that contract to end one day, and every administration since that time has had it as a stated policy. What's happened is, in the intervening years, ICANN has gone from being a few dozen technical experts to many thousands of what we call stakeholders who are involved in making addressing policy. They come from business and governments, technical communities, and even user groups. And they're organized in various committees that oversee this process of innovations and updates to the address book. And up until now, the U.S. was really sort of standing there in the corner, making sure that ICANN worked according to its rules and the will of this community. There's nothing more dramatic than really just the U.S. stepping out of its clerical oversight role.
One of the other concerns that Arizona's Attorney General has expressed is that as far as addressing goes, you know, he wants to make sure that if somebody is going to a .gov site, that it is a legitimate government site, or a .mil site is a legitimate U.S. military site. Is there any reason to think that as the U.S. sort of takes a back seat in its oversight role, that those things could be compromised in some way?
No, and in fact, the specific address names that you mention are protected through an agreement for use by the United States government. The funny, interesting, and ironic thing about the common addressing system that we all use to navigate the Internet is that it's purely voluntary and trust-based. So even if people did purport to control the address book, if ever other parties who run big networks became dissatisfied with ICANN's performance, began to disagree with how ICANN was doing its job, they could actually start their own alternative addressing system and get other networks to sign up to that. What's been great about the Internet all of these years, and the reason it looks like one single network to us, is that everyone uses one addressing system. But at any moment in time, an alternative address book might be set up and might draw users and networks away from the common system we use now.
Chris Mondini is Vice President for Global Stakeholder Engagement at the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN.
Campaign finance reports for candidates in Arizona are due today, and Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaios is already in. He's raised a stunning $12 million. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Jude Jaffe Block has an update on the race for sheriff, which is one of the most expensive local races in the country.
Please, everybody, stand up. Let Sheriff Joe know how much we all love him.
At a Tea Party meeting in Sun City West, Joe Arpaio is a rock star with this crowd of mostly white senior citizens. He's beloved here for leading the state's efforts to crack down on illegal immigration and for stumping alongside Donald Trump. The evening's raffle prize is an autographed pair of the pink boxer shorts the sheriff makes his inmates wear.
284597. There's our winner.
Sue Stock won the pink underwear and was thrilled.
We're going to frame it and put it in the living room.
Arpaio's national fan base has allowed him to raise more money for his campaign than Arizona Governor Doug Ducey did for his race 2 years ago. That means Arpaio has money on hand to blitz the airwaves with TV ads. Arpaio's been in office nearly 24 years. Stock and her husband, AJ, are rooting for Arpaio to win a seventh term at the age of 84.
If he was 150 years old, he's going to do more good. He knows how to get the job done. And for anyone else to catch up to what he knows now, it's going to take for forever. So, I mean, if he was in a wheelchair on oxygen, he's going to do a better job.
At this particular appearance, Arpaio vowed to keep investigating President Barack Obama's birth certificate. He also mentioned liberal billionaire George Soros is spending money attacking him.
It's not because they love somebody else. They just don't like me.
A group reportedly backed by Soros sent flyers to voters attacking the sheriff for failing to investigate sex crimes and for his legal troubles. 3 years ago, a judge found Arpaio's immigration enforcement efforts racially profiled Latinos. The sheriff ignored the judge's orders. Now federal prosecutors might charge him with criminal contempt of court. The legal case has already cost taxpayers almost $50 million. And for the first time in recent memory, polls show Arpaio in danger of losing.
One of my problems I've had, I haven't been able to rectify it. I love to get to the Latino community and talk to them. It's very difficult. Some of them think I'm the devil and all. I'm a nice guy. If I can get to talk to them, hey, I'll sway them my way.
Good morning. Is Blanca home?
Yeah, she.
22-year-old Maria Castro is going door to door in this heavily Latino neighborhood in South Phoenix, urging minority and young voters to turn out against Arpaio.
We've had enough of living in fear, you know, and our people aren't scared anymore.
Arpaio's been in office Castro's entire life. She's a paid canvasser with a campaign called Basta Arpaio, for the Spanish word that means enough. This work is personal to her. Her mother is from Mexico and doesn't have legal status. Castro's mother no longer works because Arpaio used to do raids targeting immigrants working without papers.
I'm the main breadwinner in my household and I'm doing this because I know that's a really real fear. My mom's been taken from us before and I don't want that to happen again.
Arpaio's opponent, Democrat Paul Penzone, is benefiting from all this anti-Arpaio organizing.
That's not a common thing you see in law enforcement where a leader has just disappointed the constituents that aggressively.
Penzone is a former Phoenix police sergeant who ran against the sheriff 4 years ago and lost in a three-way race. This year, he's the sole challenger. He says people want a sheriff, not a celebrity.
It shouldn't be that I go to another place in the country or outside the country and they know who our sheriff is. And it's for all the wrong reasons. And that's what's even more disturbing.
Penzone is financially outmatched by Arpaio, but he's hoping that after 24 years, Maricopa County is ready for a new sheriff. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In recent years, attention has been focused on unaccompanied, undocumented minors from Central America. They arrived in the U.S. and were placed in shelters. But there's another kind of situation facing mothers and kids who travel to the U.S. under similar circumstances. They're being placed in family detention centers, and some are being kept there for extended months rather than just days. Phoenix attorney Sambo Duhl has volunteered with the CARA Family Detention Pro Bono Project to offer assistance and provide legal guidance. She has a personal connection to being in an unfamiliar country at a young age with a parent who didn't speak the language. She and her family came to Phoenix from a refugee camp in Cambodia. And Bo, you were recently at the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, Texas. You were troubled by what you saw there. What was the most alarming part?
What I saw in Dilley was a lot of fear and confusion and anxiety. The mothers and children that were detained there, like you mentioned, the vast majority of them are from Central America, and they're fleeing extreme violence at the hands of criminal gangs that have basically devastated Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, making them the countries with the highest homicide rates in the world. And they've already suffered unspeakable violence in the countries that they're fleeing from, to say nothing of what they may have experienced and witnessed on the journey to arrive in the United States. So by the time they got to me, where I was meeting with them to help them prepare for the start of the legal process here to gain asylum, they were quite traumatized.
Why does the U.S. have this kind of facility?
So the government's stated rationale or objective for family detention is deterrence. We're seeking to deter other families from Central America from coming to the U.S. and seeking asylum. And that policy has utterly failed. The numbers have not gone down. And that's not surprising, given that these women are fleeing for their lives and fleeing for the lives of their children. When that is the push factor, deterrence, you don't get deterrence by implementing detention.
Is there a balance between our responsibilities to offer humane rights, to treat other people as equal humans from wherever country they come, whatever their situations are? And what about people who will say, well, they shouldn't have tried to come here in the first place, whatever the case may be? What are our obligations as human beings and as Americans when it comes to this?
I think that's a fair question. And I definitely understand the position that the U.S. can't take in everybody. But we have an obligation under both international and our own laws to provide people an opportunity to seek asylum when they express a fear of return to their home countries. And I think what often gets lost in the discussion about this influx of asylum seekers and migrants from Central America is the fact that the only way to seek asylum is to come to the border and express a fear of return to your home country. You cannot apply for asylum from wherever you are. So when I hear these families described as illegal crossers or illegal immigrants, I just don't think that that's really a fair label. I think legally speaking, they've entered without, they've come to the border without permission to enter. But because they've come to seek asylum, that's the only way to do it. There's no other way to do it. There's very limited overseas processing for people in Central America who are facing persecution. The Obama administration has started a new initiative to begin to test out the idea of overseas processing in response to the current crisis in Central America, and I think that's a very positive step forward. But until that becomes more available to a broader segment of the population, really what these women are doing, bringing their children to the border, presenting themselves and stating that they have a fear of return, is the only way to do this, and that's the system that we have set up.
And Bo, I wanted to make sure we talk a little bit about your personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
When you and your family first came to America, did you face greater obstacles than just the idea of coming into a brand new place? How did expectations meet what your family thought was going to be here?
So my family came to the U.S. from a refugee camp in Cambodia when I was very young. We lived in the camp for 4 years before we were approved to come to the United States, and we were resettled here in Phoenix, Arizona. I had aunts and uncles that had been resettled here a couple years before my family did, so we were fortunate in that sense, in that when we got here, we already had some family here that could lend support and help us get on our own 2 feet. So we lived with my aunt for many years before we were able to get our own home. What was most kind of hard for me in Dili was seeing my own mom and my own daughter and in the woman and the children that were there, and imagining how I would feel if that were them in these women's shoes. I think for me, there's a clear kind of personal calling to do this work.
Sambo Duhl is a Phoenix attorney. We've been talking about her experience volunteering as part of a pro bono project at the South Texas Family Residential Center.
The proposed Desert Discovery Center in Scottsdale's McDowell Sonoran Preserve has emerged as one of the most controversial issues in this fall's city elections and has led to spirited debates, both pro and con.
This week, the New York design team working on the DDC's concepts is in town to listen to ideas as it works on plans for the facility. And to get a sense of what those plans might look like, I'm joined by Amanda White, Senior Interpretive Planner at Think Design, and Christine Kovac. She's Board Chair of Desert Discovery Center Scottsdale. And Amanda, let me start with you. What have you come up with so far?
So this is early in the process for us, and this is part of the concept design phase, if you like, where we're working in collaboration with a lot of people that we're being introduced to and meeting at the moment. So what we've come up with so far is a set of ideas that are very much responding to everything that we've heard so far and trying to distill that into an idea that can actually inform a vision for what the center can become.
At this point, is the process sort of at the how big is it going to be? Where is it going to be? What's going to be inside it? Like you're kind of looking at everything at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the million-dollar question of how big it's going to be is certainly in our minds. And I want to tell you right away that you know, we heard loud and clear right from the beginning that was a concern. And one of the things that we've come up with in our thinking so far is that there's a real passion in the community and in the people that we have worked with for something that can make the center be a really leading project for Scottsdale. That does not presuppose an enormous footprint. In fact, what we're starting to come to is the idea of a small footprint and a big vision. And there are many ways that we can do that.
Christine, how has your group's vision of what this should be and how it should look and what it should include evolved over time?
Well, you know, the city of Scottsdale sort of started with this concept even in the 80s, and it sort of moved to the McDowell-Sonoran Preserve in the early 90s. We're going to really design this from the inside out. So it really starts with the experiences. So that's sort of why we're still going through this process, and as Amanda said, at the beginning stages of it, of still coming up with these concepts, and how then are those going to turn into experiences.
I don't have to tell you that this is a controversial project, and there are some people who would prefer that it just not happen at all. How do you try to take all of that input and put together something that maybe not everybody is going to like, but as many people as humanly possible will support?
Well, I think part of the controversy has come because there's so much misinformation about what the project is. So we're hopeful that a lot of the people who have heard the exaggerations of its size and its cost and its footprint will be open to a new perspective once we come together with our designers and our consultants. Now, there will always be those people who are opposed to anything and everything in any community about any project, about anything. So we understand that, you know, will be something that we'll always have. But we think that there will be quite a number of people who had anticipated the project was going to be X, and it's really going to be something completely different. And hopefully they will get an opportunity to see and hear our thinking, learn what's going on behind it, learn the passion and the drive to really make this a meaningful facility. So We're aware of that. Yes, it's been a challenge to sort of stay the course.
Amanda, how do you try to incorporate some of that feedback into what you're designing?
So one of the things that I've been most excited about when we first came in on this trip as well is just the passion with which everyone talks about this environment. I mean, there's such a genuine love of the desert from the people that I'm meeting. And I think that what we are really looking to do is to think about all of the local expertise, knowledge, research, understanding, and really be able to demonstrate that passion in what we designed as well.
Your firm has obviously worked on a lot of different kinds of projects mm-hmm. in the past. Have you worked on one like this that is sort of in a natural environment where there is some sentiment of we're supposed to be celebrating the natural environment, why are we building something right on top of it?
We've worked on a number of projects where we are interpreting the natural environment in places, and I think it's really pertinent to what we're doing here as well, because what we've been able to do, and I'm thinking of examples like the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. We just opened a wildlife center there. Now, it is actually in the museum grounds, but it's pertinent to their vision because they have not only a wildlife center, they also monitor and look after a number of natural areas. So by providing both a museum experience, a discovery experience, alongside an experience of the natural areas, people are understanding so much more about what they're seeing, and it's exciting for people to be able to do that. It empowers them in those environments.
What kind of timeline are you looking at for this? Because I would imagine that, you know, you want to get the details that you have to people so that they can look it over. And if at some point the city decides, yes, anything that is going to be built in the preserve will be put to a public vote, you want people to have the information, I would imagine. So how long are you looking as far as having maybe some drawings people could look at or specific ideas for what goes inside, size, things like that?
Well, our final work won't be done until our contract is up, which is in the summer of 2017. But we will be having some conceptual ideas and some schematic drawings rolling out a little bit later this fall and then certainly next spring that will start to then be able to give people a better idea. And we'll be able to gauge that with feedback and how we would make some adjustments with things.
What's the thinking as far as, at this moment at least, how much of this center you want inside, how much of it you might want outside? Because you're talking about the natural environment, mm-hmm. I would think that at least some of the museum mm-hmm. would be outside, right?
So what we've been starting to think about is a proposition where obviously we're going to need parts of it to be in some controlled environments in an interior, and that will be a design that is as sensitive to the landscape as we can possibly make it. But we're also looking at some transitional kinds of spaces that would take people from an indoor to an outdoor environment and interpreting that as well, because the history of design for those kinds of spaces in the desert is itself part of the story. You know, how do we live in the desert?
Right. And I think Amanda, you know, described it well that we're talking about living in the desert. So even though I am in my house, right, and I walk outside of my house and I have a landscaped yard, I am still in the desert. I don't drive and go to the desert. We live in Phoenix, the Phoenix Valley, and this is part of the desert. So sort of this whole mindset around how are we doing that or doing it well or not doing it well. So the ideas of indoor and outdoor spaces and cooling effects, both real as well as, you know, psychological, all of those are starting to get explored right now. So in order to keep the footprint minimal and teach what it is that we think are important concepts around sustainability and living in the desert, all of those will be incorporated.
Christine Kovac is chairman of the board of Desert Discovery Center Scottsdale. We also heard from Amanda White, senior interpretive planner at Think Design in New York, which is working on concepts for the proposed DDC.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I am the zoo light supervisor. I oversee all of the zoo lights for our zoo light season. We start usually mid-July. There's five of us, and we put up millions of lights into trees. The view of the city is really cool, and the view of the enclosures, because, yeah, you get a bird's eye view down into the exhibits.
Also, there to the right, we have the South American version of the
giraffes. When you're working somewhat close to them, you'll look over and be looking at them. You don't realize how tall they are until you're looking them in their eye, and you look down at the ground, you're like, wow, you guys are tall. We hit the ground running. We don't stop until we open.
That's Justin Davis setting up this year's Zoo Lights display at the Phoenix Zoo. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we should be in a cage, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Trade with Mexico was an issue in the first presidential debate this week. Donald Trump called NAFTA the worst trade deal in American history. But how do people along the border see the deal and the political climate?
The BBC's Joe Miller traveled the Texas-Mexico border and found at least one local politician who likes things the way they are.
I am Pete Sines. I'm the mayor of Laredo, Texas. Port Laredo is the number one land port of the entire Americas. We do over $200 billion worth of commerce just through this bridge alone. And this is where we make our bread and butter, so to speak. That's our backbone. As we know, Mexico now has become the automotive manufacturing hubs. These products flow north and south. Some of the components from the U.S. end up in Mexico, and they're actually assembled there, and so we're all interconnected.
That interconnectedness, enhanced by deals such as the 22-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA as it's known, has come under attack by both U.S. presidential candidates, who claim, to a greater or lesser degree, that it has come at the cost of American jobs. But the view from Laredo is quite different.
Granted, I know the political rhetoric nowadays is that NAFTA is bad and hadn't been good for the U.S. Maybe in some parts of the U.S. that is correct, and we feel for those people. But NAFTA has been very, very good to the border area. If you want to see NAFTA on wheels, come to Laredo, Texas. The U.S.-Mexico border provides over 6 million jobs.
That argument is one Mayor Sands, an independent, was forced to make to one visitor, the Republican presidential candidate, Donald Trump. A few months ago, Mr. Trump arrived at Laredo without much warning and with the intention of talking about the need for a crackdown on cross-border movement.
My goal was basically to educate him on border issues. So he did listen, I don't know how, for how long. But then again, he continued his same rhetoric, basically building walls. And of course, a wall here, as you can tell, we have a good sizable river between Mexico and the U.S. Keep in mind, we do have illegal or undocumented migration, but I would venture to say that there's between 30,000 or 40,000 families. They are now very much part of our economic fabric.
It's not just economics that connects Laredo to its Mexican sister city, Nuevo Laredo, but culture and history, too.
We were settled way back in 1755 by Spanish colonists, and we're very close. You know, we have family ties to the Nuevo Laredo, Mexico side, and our culture is very tied. Laredo is a 95-96% Hispanic. People think that we're somewhere, somehow, maybe the river divides us, but we think very differently. Now, keep in mind, Mexico does have issues, but the U.S. part of the border is extremely safe. So do you feel threatened some way, somehow?
I haven't felt this calm in a while.
Laredo, Texas might boast a low crime rate and relative calm, but across a thin stretch of river is one of the most violent states in Mexico, where cartel crime is a bloody feature of everyday life. But despite the fact that you only have to pick the wrong lane to find yourself across the border, many on the American side seemed shocked when we said we wanted to cross over and retrace the journey that millions make between the two cities every year.
Are you all traveling past the checkpoint?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's it, we're through. We're walking away from the Border Patrol office here and into America. It was a fairly painless experience. It took us about 50 minutes to get across in total. And save for a short delay to fill out some paperwork, it all went rather smoothly. Our car wasn't searched, none of our belongings or suitcases were either. And it's striking to think how much this very short journey can mean to those in pursuit of a better life and a future in the USA.
That report from the BBC's Joe Miller.
The Maricopa County Education Service Agency will be getting $60 million from the Federal Education Department to focus on teacher recruitment and retention. The state has had a teacher shortage for a while now. A recent survey showed districts had more than 8,000 openings at the beginning of this school year. For more on this grant and the impact it may have, I'm joined by Lori Renfro. She's the Assistant Superintendent for Human Capital Management Systems at the Maricopa County Education Service Agency. Part of her job is to oversee the implementation of teacher incentive fund grants. And Lori, what kinds of things do you hope to use this money for?
One of the things that we're going to be doing is partnering with a group called Public Impact. And we are going to be implementing an initiative that's called Opportunity Culture. And this is really focused on increasing access for our students to effective and highly effective teachers. So that's one part of what we're going to be doing. And then in addition, a big part of this, it's the title, the Teacher Incentive Fund grant. We're going to be rewarding teachers for their effectiveness. One piece of this is a retention stipend. And then in addition, there are so many things we're going to be able to do with supporting educators, both teachers and principals. So we're working to develop resources, professional development. So those are just a few of the things.
It sounds like you're trying to approach this both from the, yes, teachers need more money perspective, but also the teachers need more support perspective.
Yes, and there are so many things that we can do to support our teachers. They just need access to resources and structural things to help them get together and talk with their colleagues, and also implementing different types of career pathways so that teacher leaders can stay in the classroom and work with teachers and not have to leave the teaching profession or become an administrator.
Given that this is grant money from the federal government, how sustainable is this? I mean, is there a concern that once this grant money runs out, that the programs that you use it to implement will have to go away?
We have had a lot of experience actually working with this because we've had two prior Teacher Incentive Fund grants. So, for example, one of the pieces that they will be implementing is a revised educator salary structure. And so they're going to work in their systems to figure out, okay, we have this money from the federal grant, we have our own resources, what is a way we can think differently about how to utilize this so that as we go forward, we can sustain. So all the activities that we do, we are actually working towards sustainability so that when the grant is over, they would still have access to the resources.
How big of a dent do you think that this could put into the teacher shortage here in Maricopa County and perhaps in other parts of the state as well?
Wow, that's a hard one to answer. What I do know is we've been having a lot of success with our prior TIF grant with retention. And so with the support that comes with it and the incentives of the educator salary, we seem to be having success with keeping teachers in those systems. So that's what we hope to continue to do.
But even with that success that you've been having, I mean, there's still a problem, right? And we hear about the thousands of openings that districts across the state have had. So even though programs like this have been working in the past, they're still not necessarily getting us all the way to where we need to go, right?
Right. And I think there's multiple aspects of the problem that will require a concerted effort across a lot of entities over time. One of those issues being teacher salaries. We've got some work to do to figure out how can we raise teacher salaries in the state of Arizona. We have to figure out how do we have more people enter our universities and, our teaching programs so we can have more teachers coming into the system. But also figuring out how can we utilize what we currently have and really help our students get access to the teachers that we do have that are effective. So I think it's a multi-layered problem, and we're trying to put a dent in it, and we're trying to say, all right, so we've got these issues. What can we do right now with the teachers that we have, and then how can we consider bringing more teachers into the profession? But it's definitely a challenge.
Lori Renfro is the Assistant Superintendent for Human Capital Management Systems at the Maricopa County Education Service Agency, where she oversees the implementation of Teacher Incentive Fund grants. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. So what's it really all about? That awkward discussion in the Clinton-Trump debate about a beauty pageant winner who gained weight and had to endure being called Miss Piggy by Donald Trump. The exchange on Monday and the fallout all week long where Trump defended his statements as reasonable and the analysis by pundits that this was a, quote, clever trap set by the Clinton campaign misses a much larger point.
Research shows strongly held stereotypes that people with obesity are considered to be lazy, unsuccessful, and unintelligent. And that bias even continues in the healthcare industry, which makes billions of dollars trying to treat people with the condition of obesity.
A study in Houston showed doctors viewed patients with obesity as more annoying and a bigger waste of time than patients without the condition. As a result, patients are often misdiagnosed, with health issues being wrongly attributed to their obesity. Hattie Neese serves on the Obesity Action Coalition's Weight Bias Committee, and Dr. Catherine Saunders is an obesity expert at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian.
So I think there's a common misperception that obesity has to do with willpower, when in fact obesity is classified as a disease. So I think having that understanding when treating patients with obesity is extremely important.
So what do you do to educate doctors? I mean, how did doctors approach this medical condition? I mean, did they just learn about the biology of obesity and bring their biases straight into the examination room?
That's a wonderful question, and that's something that at our center, the Comprehensive Weight Control Center at Weill Cornell Medicine, we are striving to work on. When I went to medical school, I really learned very little about obesity, but obesity medicine is one of the fastest growing specialties.
So, Patty, your experience with physicians really indicates directly how this can be painful and really affect the way in which healthcare professionals deal with you. What's your experience?
Bias in the medical community and in medical settings can occur in various ways. It can be very subtle, things like not having appropriate equipment, such as a large enough blood pressure cuff to get an accurate reading on a patient, or even the chairs in the waiting room. But it can also be very overt and direct. I saw an orthopedist because I was having severe hip pain, and x-rays of my hips had not disclosed an obvious answer. He walked into the room, and I started telling him my symptoms, and he said, "Let me cut to the chase. You need to lose weight." Well, at that point in time, I had the very good fortune of working with a wonderful obesity medical specialist, and I had lost about 70 pounds. And I said to the orthopedist, "I'm surprised this is happening now because I have lost about 70 pounds. And his response, without batting an eye, was, "You need to lose more weight. Have you considered weight loss surgery?" By the end of his rant, I was in tears because I was humiliated and ashamed. And he said, "Look, you're even crying because of the pain and because of your weight." That's not why I was crying. I was crying because of the way he had treated me. And I lived through the pain for several more months and finally found another orthopedist who correctly diagnosed me as having severe progressive scoliosis in my back. I have a 60-degree curve in my spine. And that was what was actually causing my hip pain.
Does this raise the issue, Dr. Saunders, that doctors have a difficult time separating behavioral issues from medical issues, say, for example, with addiction? It would be difficult to treat someone with addiction if they come in and you go, "Well, why don't you stop using heroin, you big dummy?" I mean, that's just not going to be helpful.
Yes, I think that's a big part of the problem. I think also a lot of doctors just jump to the assertion that patients need to lose weight without even asking, especially in Patty's condition. Her story really exemplifies this, what a patient has already done. It's very easy to just look at somebody and say, "Oh, your obesity is causing this and you need to lose weight," without really delving into what's going on.
And that's really what this is all about, Patty, empathy. When Donald Trump uses that behavior in talking about a beauty pageant winner, Ms. Machado, he's basically using language that is tolerated in America for people
right.
with obesity, but he's not showing any empathy, and that's really the problem.
Right. And that's a big problem. And, you know, weight bias in our society is ubiquitous. You can't watch a sitcom without seeing it. And I think it's so ingrained that people don't even recognize it when it's smacking them in the face. When you're told your entire life by the medical community, by the media, that you're not good enough or it's all your fault, that you've made a choice to have obesity, you know, you start taking that on board. And we need to stop because it's just not true. We've had decades of advice to exercise more and eat less, and look where we're at.
Dr. Saunders, this whole issue with Donald Trump has been about an individual who doesn't seem to be in control of his biases regarding Arabs, regarding immigrants, And now, regarding obesity, they're all part of the same thing here, it seems. And how difficult is this to get changed, whether we're talking about doctors or just society in general?
That's a great question. I think that what's required is quite a bit more education. So educating doctors on understanding that obesity is, in fact, a disease and that it is very complicated. And as Patty said, the answer is not eat less and exercise more. If that were the answer, we wouldn't be in the middle of an obesity epidemic. And also educating patients, I think, is very important for patients to understand that it's not right for them to be discriminated against and they deserve better care.
Dr. Catherine Saunders is an obesity expert at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Patty Neese is an attorney and serves on the Obesity Action Coalition's Weight Bias Committee. Thanks so much, Patty.
Thank you.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
Every one of us is susceptible to salespeople when we're in a consumer mode, and even on the personal level, when we meet someone new who could become a friend or romantic partner. In his new book, Persuasion, Robert Cialdini, professor emeritus of psychology and marketing at ASU, explores the methods of putting us in something like a comfort zone in the moments before we may purchase something or get to know someone else more deeply. And Bob Cialdini joins me now to talk about it. Bob, what is the definition of persuasion?
Persuasion has to do with what a communicator can arrange for an audience to become more sympathetic to a message before they encounter it.
So how much planning has to go into that? Is that something that can be spontaneous?
It can be spontaneous. It's best when arranged in a thoughtful way, so that the idea is if we can put people in a mindset that makes them open and receptive to our message before they encounter it, they will be more willing to be aligned with it and move in conjunction with it.
So how much of persuasion is dependent upon what I bring as a person, and how much of it is the surroundings and the situation?
Well, I think that's a great question, and here's what I'm going to suggest on the basis of new social psychological research. Who we are in a particular moment is where we are paying attention in that particular moment. If a communicator can get us to deflect our attention to something like romance, for example, suddenly we become a romantic. If the person can get us to deflect our attention to money, suddenly we become a cost-oriented individual.
Now, is it a sign of just the human condition, or is it a sign of sort of weakness or vulnerability that we find ourselves in these situations and are able to be persuaded?
I think it's both. A feature of the human condition, it operates on all of us, and it can be exploited as a weakness. Of course, it doesn't have to be. I think people can do this ethically and still be effective.
Now, I think about the car buying experience, which for many people is daunting. There have been things put into effect, though, where there are fleet sales, you can do the internet thing, so you don't really necessarily have to negotiate when it comes to that. But I find that most people don't really enter into that transaction. Even if they're excited about getting a new car, they don't look forward to the actual transaction part of it. Is there something that car dealers or other people in that sort of realm do to make us feel more comfortable about buying the product?
Absolutely. And it often doesn't have to do with the car itself. It has to do with the salesperson who gives us a bottle of water on a hot day, who compliments us, who remarks that, oh, really, my wife grew up where you grew up, that sort of thing. And we become more inclined toward positive feelings toward this individual. What we have to recognize is that we'll be driving that Toyota off the lot, not that salesperson.
If we know we're going in, we're not going in to meet the salesperson. We're not going in to make a new friend necessarily. We're going in to actually purchase something. So why are we so seemingly open or susceptible to this kind of thing?
Because normally it makes sense to deal with people we like. So if somebody can get us to like them, then we have a natural tendency to go along with what this individual suggests.
Do you find yourself being persuaded, and do you allow yourself to be persuaded?
Yes, I am persuaded, provided that it's done in an ethical way. The last time I bought a TV set, I was in an appliance store, and I saw a set that looked like it was a great buy for the quality. And the salesperson came up to me and said, I can see you're interested in this this TV at this price. I can understand why. It's a great deal, but I have to tell you, it's our last one. And there's a woman who just called from Scottsdale, and she's on her way to pick it up. Steve, 5 minutes later, I'm rolling out of that place with a TV in my cart.
Well, Bob, then there's no hope for the rest of us then to resist this.
Well, here's the key. I went back the next day to see if it really had been the last one. Was he being straight with me? Was it really the only one left? If it was, he did me a favor, and I don't begrudge that at all. If it wasn't, if there was another one in that spot, right, then everyone I talked to would hear about this story, and I'd be telling them, don't go there. They're not straight with you.
Robert Cialdini's new book is called Persuasion, and Bob, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.